This is Money Moves on VSiN, the sports betting network.
Well, I already know JVT must be glowing from the result in Game 3 in the Stanley Cup Final. Lots to get to as we welcome you in to Money Moves on a Tuesday. VSiN, the sports betting network, SiriusXM Channel 158. Stormy Bonantoni, Jonathan Von Tobel with you. We're live in downtown Las Vegas, Circa Resort and Casino. You also, but prior to the results yesterday, went golfing. How was that?
Correct.
Did it go well?
It was just a par 3, cloud 9 out here in town, so it went as well for somebody of my level. As I like to say, I am nowhere near good enough at golf to be mad that I'm bad. So my objective every single time is try to hit shots consistently. I had 3 of my best shots of my life yesterday.
Really?
Yes, very good. There was a long par 3 that I don't know in golf terms if this sounds terrible.
I mean, they're again. All I'm par 3s, but go on.
Right. It was a long par 3 that – With a 7-iron, I laced that thing within like 4 feet of the pin. Absolutely brilliant. Had about 3 of those shots yesterday, so I'm working on it. It's going a lot better. So consistently hitting it in the same direction is what I did yesterday. So.
Yes, which is not easy to do.
Kill the rabbit.
That's so bad. And with a golf on the brain, of course, it is U.S. Open week, which I think is a fair place to start our rundown for the
similar
day.
Similar level of golf.
Obviously, not as many bunkers there as we'll have at Oakmont, but let's set it up. Time for the rundown.
It's time for the top headlines and topics of the day. This is the rundown.
So, JVT, yes, we're going to preview the U.S. Open later. Stephen Hennessy, managing editor of Golf Digest, is going to help us do that. Same with Adam Burke, managing editor here at beeson.com. We'll get a lot of different angles on this thing. But as someone like myself who is... bad at golf and a pretty casual golf viewer and better. Oakmont in particular is just one of the coolest courses. I am okay. So freaking excited for this week because there's going to be so much chaos. Yep. And it favors golfers that are consistent, to your point about how challenging the sport is.
My second favorite major of the 4. My first is the Open out there across the pond because you like those odd hours of watching it early in the morning, late at night, whatever. But very much looking forward to the U.S. Open. It's great. I think golfers are some of the softest athletes out there in terms of their mentality. Everything's got to be perfect. Everything, stop to the change in your pocket. I need to be able to focus. The U.S. Open makes these guys pull their hair out. Yeah. And I absolutely love the challenge that these dudes have to endure in these sort of tournaments. I'm very much hoping that's going to be the case this week.
You have to hit it long off the tee. You have to be accurate in doing so. The rough is crazy. The greens are fast. Like, this entire course just makes for chaos and I feel like is going to be such a fun event that's going to your point, test so many of these guys. Bets to be made, of course, when we get into that with Steven and Adam. Also, who will start week 1? Lots of quarterback news, potential intrigue in some of those prop markets in the NFL, plus with mandatory minicamps getting underway around the league. JVT, a handful of key players will not be attending for contract reasons. Trey Hendrickson in Cincinnati, I don't think that's a big surprise, but TJ Watt in Pittsburgh, is that a big deal? Washington star wide receiver Terry McLaurin, does that... is anything that we should be reading into? Lots of interesting news coming out of the league.
Yeah, I'm generally not going to be too freaked out about those things, but I will say when you look at some of these starting quarterback markets, again, they don't take that much, but one of those prices looks really, really cheap.
Okay, that'll be good. By the way, with these mandatory minicamps, I know that for millionaires, losing $100,000 isn't as big a deal to them, but I can't help but think that's like 10 years of my first job out of college.
Yeah,
how much they're losing for 3 days in fines. And then last but certainly not least, we referenced it at the top. What the heck happened in Game 3 last night, the Stanley Cup Final? The Panthers make an easy work of the Oilers after all the talk we had yesterday about through the first 2 games there being no real discernible difference through these two. The Florida Panthers came out early and often, showed up big. They take a 2-1 advantage in the series, home ice again on Thursday. The over cashes, and I hope you had the over on penalties as well. Listen to these numbers. 35 total penalties. 140 minutes in total penalty minutes, 17 power plays, Edmonton catching the worst of it, of course. Florida scores 3 goals on 11 power play attempts, and it started early, too. Second game in a row where we've had fewer than 9 minutes of 5-on-5 action in the first period, and it just kept going. Third period was chaotic.
So I think there's a lot to go from here for this series, and I'm curious what you think is more important to talk about. I feel like there's an easy answer here. Is it your Edmonton Oilers, I think, clearly falling apart mentally in that game? Or is it the fact that they have to strongly consider changing goaltender going into game four?
I think it is the – I don't think it's the latter. I don't think it's the Stuart Skinner problem.
Okay.
Especially considering he got hung out to dry on a couple of those.
I don't know, man. I thought he played like crap. Again, I'm a novice. You have watched way more hockey than I have. The first goal, he's like 10 feet out of the crease. I'm obviously exaggerating a little bit, but he's like 10 feet out of the crease, and he gives it up easy, like right away, and you're like – brother, what are you doing? He gets beat short side twice. You're like, come on, man. Like,
so
what's going on?
It's no secret. It's a bad day for him. I think he probably should have gotten pulled a little bit earlier, but I also understand Chris Knobloch not wanting to do that because of what a good third period team Edmonton has been. Even down 4-1, you still don't have a complete fear that they're totally out of it and they're going to actually get blown out like the 6-1 result we saw because of what they've done with a historic number of comebacks and the goal differential that they have in the third period. Skinner specifically is a guy who can have masterful moments, but is not consistent with that. We've talked about that a ton. That was a big glaring issue we had coming into the postseason to begin with, is his lack of consistency. So you expect to have some of those moments from him. I don't think that means he's toast coming into the next game. And Greg Wyshynski of ESPN asked Chris Knobloch about that after the game. He said they haven't made any decisions just yet, but he did reference he doesn't think all of those goals were on him. And I don't think they all were, but it was a bad day for him, certainly.
I think the third goal he gives up? I can't remember who it was, but like he's staring right at the guy.
Sam Reinhardt?
Yeah, goal? I think like Reinhardt, they're locked eyes with each other. There's not really that much traffic at all in front of him. He still gets beat short side. Mentioned the first goal. I don't think his defense in front of him played particularly well either. But we were talking about this, and it's funny how you approach different conversations of essentially the same point, which is, so we were, and you have nailed this in terms of where the market has gone. We're talking about Conn Smythe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how Bobrovsky, I don't know, man, these last few games, he's given up like 3 or 4 goals each, and maybe that takes him out of contention for this thing because he hasn't played particularly well because we set the bar for Bobrovsky so high.
Correct.
Meanwhile, on the other side, we have a guy that has played that badly and, in fact, worse now after what happened yesterday. And, like, we're viewing it from Bobrovsky's standpoint of he's not in contention for the highest honor from these postseasons outside of winning the Stanley Cup. And then for Skinner now, I think we should talk more about, like, bro, through 3 games, my man has been subpar is, I think, a kind way to say it. And he's very lucky that his team tilted the ice at overtime in game 1 and absolutely abused Florida, because if they don't, they're talking about being down 3-1 in this
series. I'll give him credit between the two. I think he was the better goaltender in game 2. But obviously Bobrovsky was better in game 2. And clearly, like, it, with what we saw last night. And to go back to saying it started early, yes, with the penalties, but also with this game just tilting in Florida's favor – you see Brad Marchand score that goal in the first minute, which another goal in the first 10 cashes, by the way. Goal in the first 10, first period overs have been money. But he scores that goal. Edmonton goes on the early first period power play, and Bobrovsky is incredible. They had some great grade A chances. I think shots after that were like 8-2 in Edmonton's favor. But Bobrovsky really took some of that will away from them early. And then they obviously score the late goal in the first period as well to go up 2-0. And I think that first period really set the tone for what ultimately we saw. Now, to go back to your earlier question, though, about the agitation layer of this.
They fell apart.
Like a cookie in milk, they crumbled, JVT.
They fell apart.
To a man, I listened through every single player that spoke in postgame this morning. And
Were you judging the questions?
Always. What can I say?
Yeah, of course.
But to a man, they all said that, no, they didn't get under our skin, which is a blatant lie.
It's so true. They had like, again, I know this is like a hockey thing. I was reading some quotes afterwards where the Panthers were talking like, what are they talking about? Like end of the second period to each other. Like, hey, one of us is going to get like, they're going to come after one of us. Like we have to be ready for this. And of course they go after Bennett. Like they sent somebody after Bennett because they were getting their ass kicked so bad. Like, yes, that's absolutely ridiculous. They would try to say that.
They took the bait and everything. And this is how Florida likes to play. They want to play that physical grinding game. They want shots after the whistle. They want stoppages. And like that is what they like to do. And Edmonton just completely fell into the trap. I just think they need to focus on playing their own game instead of trying to beat Florida at theirs. And when you see Edmonton try to get in fights, they're getting beat up. Florida players are going full Joker, smiling with blood in their teeth. You know, it's a different thing. I do want to hear from Evander Kane here real quickly before we have to hit the break, because he said after the game, as the Oilers tried to match Florida's physicality, they were penalized more than Florida was for doing the same stuff.
They seem to get away with it more than we do. I mean, you know, it's tough to find the line. It's you know, they're doing just as much stuff as we are. You know, it was 4-4 at the end of it, and then it gets out of hand, and, you know, there seems to be a little bit more attention in our group. Look, it's losing in the playoffs, whether it's in round one, game one, or the Stanley Cup final, it's never a good feeling. But, you know, we've been here before. We've been down in series before, and we've had tough losses. So, you know, it's it'll sting right now, and we'll flush it tomorrow and get ready for Thursday.
I do think his last point is an interesting one of it. Like, what's easier to walk away from? Is it the tight double overtime heartbreaking loss, or is it this a game that you got blown out and try to move on to the next one?
I mean, I think it depends on where you're at. I think this makes this one a little bit harder because not only were you smoked here, you're going right back to that Hornets
right.
nest. And it's not like you're at home in the next game and that's really easy to wash it off. No, you're back out there. Again, something that you were on. It seemed like all of a sudden I was sitting out at a bar yesterday and I look at my watch. Pierre LeBrun has mentioned you. I was like, what the hell? We were mentioned in a comment from him about like the ice and the yep. way it was getting a little choppy out there for them.
Yep.
And that seems to have affected them a little bit.
Yeah,
and that's not going to go anywhere.
I was mad about the total because the read was correct
yeah.
on how it was going to affect Edmonton.
The other one just got whooped.
And yeah, and you would think if the Edmonton Oilers score one goal that this is going to be an under game, but yet here we are. So, yeah, there were that. As we look at the price for game four coming up in Florida on Thursday, -148 favorites. Florida is to go up 3-1 in the series price now. They are -260 to win it all. Okay, and we'll get to that question and a whole lot more. We're just getting started here on Money Moves. Stick around. VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
Money Moves here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
Back here on Money Moves, live in downtown Las Vegas, Circa Resort and Casino. He's JVT. I'm Stormy Bonantoni. A little more quick reaction from last night in the Stanley Cup Final. Did want to say, if you followed on any of the bets, although the lean on the total going under doesn't come through, good day for props at decent plus money. We had the Nate Schmidt assist, which cashed early, +250. Sam Bennett scores another goal. Just that dude is on a tear right now. 14 goals to lead the NHL postseason. I know a little bit later on in the show, we're going to go through the updated Conn Smythe ladder, but he goes from 20-1 a few days ago in this market to now a +175 favorite. Alexander Barkov doesn't get there again, but the line did get going, and that was kind of the thought process that we talked about with the top line. Barkov, like, he's noticeable on the ice. He's just not getting on the score sheet, which is a little frustrating.
Yes. So I have a question for you.
What do we got?
I think there's a couple of different ways for me to ask this, but I will just ask generally, are you nervous?
Yeah.
This team's got to beat Florida 3 out of the next 4 games now.
I know sometimes you watch on like, you'll have ESPN on in the morning every now and then, get up.
Don't put that evil on me.
I know you do. You've told me before. They always play this game of bad game or bad sign.
Sure.
And that's very much so what was kind of, like, ringing through my head with the result of yesterday. Like, is this an instance where Florida now officially has a good tactical advantage and read on how to compete and quiet Leon Draisaitl and Connor McDavid? Because they were held off the score sheet yesterday. That does not happen between the two of them, especially in the same game. And so have they figured something out, and are they now capable of running away with it, especially on home ice? Again, as you referenced coming up in this next game, potential to go up 3-1. What does that look like? Yeah, I'm a little nervous, I would say, after last night's performance.
It's never fair to play this game, but the other part of this too is, as much as this looked even, if you really like look at these games, you're talking about Florida blowing a 3-1 lead in game one and then ultimately losing the game. Mm-hmm. Game two, eventually they do win in double overtime, but you needed to pull your goaltender and put an extra man on the ice to get that done in the waning seconds. And then you have this result.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really, if you can, you know, get your head out of your rear end in game one, if you're Florida, you're realistically looking at a series in which you're up 3-0 as opposed to just 2-1. And then there's that aspect of, like, Utah. I mean, I don't think it's a good sign when a team is going, no, like, you didn't bother me. That's,
yeah,
like, that's the ultimate sign of, like, dude, we're bothering
yeah.
you. You know? And I just, that was, I thought that was somewhat troubling. And that's why we go back to game one, too. And I remember asking you, it was just, look, I watched the Florida team that I thought they did so many things that were just not part of their DNA. the penalties.
Yeah, you mentioned just correctable issues. Play.
Right, and it looked like it looks like the last two games, they've pretty much corrected those issues.
And I do also wonder, and I don't know enough about the deep intricacies of rest in the NHL, but for Florida this past weekend, like, they took a break. Mm-hmm. They didn't skate at all. They had an optional. Meanwhile, Edmonton had, like, a full skate on Sunday. So is there anything to that? I don't know. Maybe like a combination of factors for Edmonton where it's been such a long season. You had guys that have come back from injuries. You're fatigued. You're banged up. Everybody's banged up at this point in the year, but you're banged up. Then you travel. You're going to ice that sucks compared to what you're used to. You're facing a team that's physical and now has the advantage of last change. Maybe this is just an adjustment period type of a thing. I don't know, but I didn't like it from Edmonton. And you wonder now, is this going to be a situation where I don't want to say they pack it in, because mentally you're still going to come in and do everything that you can. It's the Stanley Cup final. But if you just don't show up with the same mentality, or if it's another Connor McDavid, let's dig the bleep in type of a moment that helped them rally last year. Yeah. I don't know what we're going to see just yet.
Florida is six, plus 230, the favorite in terms of the options for the exact outcome of the series.
And I did just want to say too, John A. Cornell tweeting at the show, I do agree with this, and I know Zach Hyman is somebody that you brought up coming into the series. I didn't think it was going to be as significant as it has shown to be so far, but he said losing Zach Hyman marginalizes Edmonton's physicality against Florida. This isn't the same team that came back against LA and dominated Dallas, and Florida is better than they were last year. He says Cats in six. I agree that Florida is better than they were last year, but I think Edmonton is too. And I have to find the numbers for this, because our guy, Jonathan Davis, VSiN, NHL hockey betting expert, he sent me a note this morning of the time trailing. Here it is. Against the Stars, time trailing for the Edmonton Oilers, 14 minutes and 2 seconds. Against the Panthers, 126 minutes and 12 seconds. They are forced to play a different game, and trailing is not part of it right now. Although yes, we've talked about all the comebacks and like the ways that they've been able to perform in the third period.
Sure.
It's been ugly so far for them.
I mean, it seems somewhat Pacers-esque in that if you're just banking on, hey man, in clutch time and in these third periods, we're gonna be fine. We got this.
Yeah, you can't do that.
You've been doing it, but like to rely on it, I think, is the problem. It's a good skill to have. But for that to be the reliance, for that to be the way that you're buttering the bread, I think that's part of the problem.
I was surprised that they didn't put up more of a fight figuratively on the ice. They sure put up a fight literally, it was just bad. Okay, but you mentioned
they got their ass kicked there too, by the way. I think they lost every single one of those fights.
Yes. You know that they're desperate when you've got Wallman spraying water across the ridiculous.
I know hockey fans come at me if you want. That was lame. Like, that was lame
it
on
was
Edmonton's part.
Stupid.
That seemed like a child who was not having its way and decided to just lash out. That was absolutely ridiculous. And that, to me, we can go with all the data out of the window. That, to me, was a sign when I was watching that. I was like, oh, like, these boys got him. Like, from a mental edge standpoint, that was one where I was like, ooh, like, Florida's got him right where they want him. And we'll see what happens in game four. Connor McDavid is an incredible player, so I'll never say no to his ability to bring a team back and do something like this. But, I mean, right now, there is a team that is clearly playing with a little bit of an edge, and that is the team that is in control of the series.
They didn't let McDavid do anything. Draisaitl didn't even have a shot attempt yesterday. So you mentioned Pacers-esque, though, the way that Edmonton has come back and rallied so many times. Pacers obviously did that in game one to steal one in OKC. Game two, they get blown out. So maybe another parallel to this series where it was just a demolition from OKC in game two. Now the series shifts to Indiana. Spread here, Thunder laying 5.5 on the road. Total, 228. So a tick down from the 228.5. But your early thoughts here on game three coming up tomorrow?
I mean, under was probably the prevailing thought for me here. I understand what Indiana wants to do. I understand people think that maybe back at home they'll be able to do it. OKC's just so good on defense, man. Like, they've been able to corral this offense through two games, and I don't see how just playing out at home, maybe your shooting gets better, but in terms of your ability to find open lanes in transition, that's not a home or road shooting backgrounds thing, right? That is a team that is disciplined in the way that they play transition defense, and I think that the Thunder are going to be able to continue to do that, play at a very high level defensively in transition. So I don't think that's really going to change, and I think that this leads to, yet again, another kind of grittier, lower-scoring game that we have seen the last few days. Now, the second game, I think it just eked over the total, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong. I have to go back and look. But either way, I think that this has been a series that trends itself toward the under, and I think that's going to be the same thing here. This was the fourth best transition defense in the NBA in the regular season in terms of points allowed per play off of live rebounds in transition, and I just don't think that that's going to change anytime soon here in this series, even with a high-level of opponent like Indiana.
You mentioned yesterday you added Pascal Siakam.
Ooh, let's go. Come on.
Series most rebounds. He and Isaiah Hartenstein both with 17 top of the series right now.
See our boys? You see that list?
What list?
Assists. You got
right in front of you.
Yeah, come on now. Come on now. Series leader in assists. Tyrese Halliburton's got 12.
Only one back. Yep. We're only one back.
Shea's only one back. Jalen Williams only one back as well. So we're live. We're live with the long shots. Come on now. We got to get this in.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of potential. I think SGA will get there for us. Yep. I do. But as far as, like, the points one, SGA is 72 points through the first two games.
Oh, that's
an NBA record, by the way, for a player in his first NBA Finals.
We're done.
That's just over and done with. There's nothing anyone can do.
Yeah. In these markets, like what we're bringing these up for, you see the gap there. That's why I bet Pascal Siakam. Again, if you look at, like, the leaders here, he's tied with Isaiah Hartenstein, yes, but at least he's in the lead. He's going to have a massive minutes edge on Hartenstein. The way they use him, he's going to have more opportunities to rebound it. To Halliburton, Aaron Nesmith. Halliburton's a good rebounder. They want him to rebound it because, again, if he gets it, they're going to run. It's a really good opportunity for him to grab a rebound, start a transition opportunity. I don't think they're going to be there as often for him. So I think this lends itself to Siakam grabbing this. So I thought plus 150, very much worth adding in terms of series rebounds leader.
Okay, we talked about this a little bit too yesterday, but can the Pacers still steal? I mean, I guess it's not stealing anymore, but can they win another one at home considering what a big favorite OKC is? I think potentially. I'm just not sure that that's going to be game one in Indiana with the way that OKC played the other night. I think they might need to settle back in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more curious. I would tend to agree, and again, I predicted in five. I have bets that this thing's going to end in five, so I hope it's not the case. But as we've talked about, Stormy, one of these two teams has not covered a road game in the postseason, and it's not the team at home. So Oklahoma City has been a very bad road team by their standards in the postseason. We'll see if that changes here, but playing on foreign courts has not been their deal, and the role players haven't really shown up, and I wouldn't be surprised if it happens in either this game or game four.
There will be a full game three preview up on VSiN.com later on today. Also up on the site as of now, Greg Peterson breaking down his MLB best bets, Steve Mackinnon with a bullpen update, and U.S. Open prop bets, which is actually where we're going to go next. Stephen Hennessy, managing editor of Golf Digest, is going to help us break down all of the action at Oakmont Country Club. Coming up after this.
You're watching Money Moves here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
The third major on tour this weekend is the U.S. Open returns to Oakmont Country Club, widely referred to as golf's greatest test, a notoriously difficult course. Excited to get into it as we welcome you back here to Money Moves alongside JVT, Stormy Bonantoni with you. Welcoming in now via the Progressive guest line, Stephen Hennessy, managing editor over at Golf Digest. You can follow him on X at @S_HennessyGD. And Stephen, the thickness and dampness of the rough already causing problems during practice rounds. We saw Bryson DeChambeau and Ben Griffin, your guy who you've talked up a good bit on this show in the past, both given examples of videos of the ball just totally being hidden in the rough there. What are your expectations for this course coming up this weekend?
Yeah, I think the USGA is trying to get back to the traditional U.S. Open test of really thick rough, really testing the players in the most complete way as we see all year. You know, I think we saw in some past U.S. Opens, scores got into the double digits under par, and that's just not quite what we expect from a U.S. Open. So, you know, always at Oakmont, like you said, this is the most complete test these players face. And, you know, you look at 07, Angel Cabrera won at 4 over par. That's the highest total score all the way back to 1972. When Dustin Johnson won, it was 4 under par. I'm expecting a very brutal examination this week. The last two times it was at Oakmont, there was graduated rough. So, you know, if you were slightly off, and these fairways are so narrow, so everyone's going to miss fairways. It's not graduated this week. You're right into 5-inch thick rough. They're cutting it in a way so golf balls sink all the way down to the bottom. You know, we've talked about in past major championships, oh, you know, the rough is really going to stop them. It's going to curb all this distance that we see on tour now. And that doesn't end up being the case once the tournament starts. I really think it has the potential to level the playing field a little bit and let a more accurate player compete with the guys who are just bombing it, like Bryson DeChambeau, 330 yards on average out there. I do think this is going to be a really awesome week and has the potential to really play out the way the USGA hopes it will.
So if this is going to be as challenging as we think and we expect, Stephen, we'll start at the top then and ask the obvious question we ask almost every single week. Does Scottie Scheffler deserve to be this short of a favorite in a tournament that could push him and the others?
Yeah, I think the odds are certainly deserving. We've seen this last month or so, this stretch that he's on, winning three of the last four events. It is reminiscent of Tiger Woods, and you know, I think back to 07, when Angel Cabrera won here, Tiger was a very similar favorite, actually more of a favorite. He was minus 125 to win the Masters in 2007. Didn't win there. He did win the next major and was battling with Angel Cabrera here. Didn't end up winning, but he had won five of the last 10 majors entering here. So, you know, it goes to show how difficult it is to beat an entire field. So Scottie's odds, rightfully so. You know, you look at all the stats, strokes gained. He is far and away the best player in the world. But Oakmont has trouble lurking in all directions. And, you know, a slight miss, which Scottie is good for a few misses off the tee. What makes him so great is his ability to recover. So, you know, certainly most likely champion at the end of the week is Scottie. So depending on how you want to play it, you know, maybe you look at the odds of, you know, he wins by two strokes or more. But, you know, the books are smart now, guys. You know, they've priced this down to, instead of plus 280, he's plus 440 to win by two strokes. So, you know, you're not really gaining too much. You have to get a little creative in the Scottie market. Probably the best way to do it from an outright perspective is to bet in the without Scottie Scheffler market. So that's when we were talking about the Charles Schwab a couple weeks ago. That's what I recommended. I would probably recommend a similar thing. That's just how good Scottie's been this year.
Stephen Hennessy, managing editor, Golf Digest, joining us here on Money Moves. So from that standpoint, if we are going to the without Scottie Scheffler market, what was your approach to the board and the players specifically that you think could have a better showing on a course that is so challenging?
Yeah, it's a short list for me. I think, you know, I do think there is the potential for a shorter, more accurate player to get to the top. In my mind, that just screams Shane Lowry to me. He led here at Oakmont by four shots in 2016, 9 years ago. He's a more complete player right now. He had a hot Sunday last week in Canada. I mean, he's been so consistent this year, just has not got over the finish line. But perhaps in a week where you don't have to make 15 birdies, this could play into Shane Lowry's wheelhouse. So, you know, there are 50 to ones in the with Scottie market, a 35 or 40 to one in the without market. I think those are interesting. I think Tommy Fleetwood is right there. I mean, they're basically the same player. At this point, they're European Ryder Cuppers. They can't win on U.S. soil. They're super accurate off the tee. They're gaining in all the strokes gained categories. You know, Tommy Fleetwood has been so close. The thing that makes me really believe in him this week, guys, is the U.S. Open record. He's shown the ability to grind it out and make pars, and you know he has that mental fortitude. He backs that up by being the best player that he's ever been, tee to green wise. So if there was ever a week for Tommy Fleetwood to prove all the doubters wrong, I do think this would be a great week for it. So Fleetwood and Lowry are the two options that really shout, you know, a great bet at the top. I haven't yet pulled the trigger on Jon Rahm at 9-1 in the without Scottie Scheffler market, but I really want to. You know, everyone knows he was close to the PGA last time at Quail Hollow. He now has three top 15s at majors in a row, and that's proving all the doubters wrong, who said, oh, you know, he went to LIV. He doesn't care about the majors anymore. Well, he's been a factor in all of these, and I think this is a great chance for him, too. You know, we saw Dustin Johnson play a power fade off the tee at Oakmont to perfection in 2016. That's John Rahm's shot of choice. He's a U.S. Open champion at Torrey Pines. I do see him being in the mix here. If Scottie Scheffler gets the best of him, again, you know, 9-1, those are pretty good odds on him to finish runner-up to Scottie. So I haven't yet made that bet, but I have a feeling at the end of the week I'm going to.
My Moby Dick, Tom Fleetwood. Let's go. I need to have it done. He's been my Moby Dick since the U.S. Open all the way back at Shinnecock all those years ago. So I've been very much looking forward to him maybe getting one of these. All right, Stephen, so let me ask you this. If we're going to look at some of these more accurate guys, maybe going against these bombers, is there a way to actively fade some of these guys? Like, would you look to play against some of them in certain matchups? Would there be a certain strong guy off the tee you'd be looking to play against in tournament-long matchups?
Yeah, I think you look at some of the guys at the top of the board. So Justin Thomas is somebody who that's his bugaboo. You know, it's the putting can be inconsistent, but it's the inconsistency off the tee. And you know, he talked earlier this week in press conferences how you know he's going to club down, he's going to play smart. Well, you know that mentality and that approach all change when you're one over or you're a couple over through the first couple holes and you start to press a little bit. So I would be very comfortable fading Justin Thomas. He's been very good this year, but just really tends to struggle when we get to a difficult golf course, and Oakmont is certainly at the top of that list. Colin Morikawa might be somebody as well. It's just been weird with him this year, guys. He's super consistent through like three of the four rounds and then just kind of all falls apart in one of those rounds. And he's going to need to be on his A-plus game. I don't think his ceiling is high enough at this course with this rough. He doesn't have the club head speed that some of these other guys do to extract his ball out of this rough. So he's going to need to hit all of his 200-yard iron shots to, you know, 25 feet consistently on these greens where it's impossible to stop them. That's difficult to do. So I would look at those guys to fade. Those are two, sub 50-1 guys who are good fades for me.
Steven, appreciate the insight. Thank you for joining us. Enjoy the weekend.
Thanks, guys. Enjoy it.
Steven Hennessy, everybody. Make sure you check out all the work over there at Golf Digest. And, you know, JVT, I'm surprised one guy he didn't mention there in players to fade is Rory McIlroy, who we've seen his odds significantly drop from, I think it was around 6-1 after the RBC Canadian, now 12-1 in that market, misses the cut by 12 shots this past weekend. The driver issues continue. And in a place where you need to be accurate off the tee, I feel like that's a guy that I would probably draw a line through as well.
Well, he can be wild, like you mentioned. So trying to find a new driver, a big issue for him too. So I'll be looking to play against him. But dear God, watch out, world, if either Shane Lowry or Tommy Fleetwood win the U.S. Open. Because this show.
It was so funny. Like, you couldn't see us, but when Steven mentioned Shane Lowry, I'm going like this with the hands in the air. Tommy Fleetwood, you did the same. So don't let us get hot. Okay, we got to take a timeout when we come back. Mandatory minicamps underway in the NFL. We'll break down some of the news there and some who will start week one quarterback odds.
You're watching Money Moves here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
Back here on Money Moves, VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. You remember, VSiN fans, Circa Survivor and Circa Million contests are up. And how would you like to play for free this season? Well, Winner Circle Proxy is giving away one free $1,000 entry to each of the contests, plus full proxy service. And get this, you'll be paired with a VSiN host for strategy all season long as well. Enter now for your chance to win. Head over to winnercircleproxy.com/VSiN. That's winnercircleproxy.com/VSIN. The football season will be here before you know it. We got mandatory mini camps underway around the NFL. Some interesting news coming in, guys that are on site and we see the highlight plays, guys who are not there and what that might mean for their contracts and the start to the season. Also just saw a nice little quote here from James Palmer about C.J. Stroud, quarterback for the Houston Texans. Of course, we know he's been dealing with some, according to D'Amico Ryans, full body soreness, but shoulder soreness
those
on
my life.
Other reports, right? Yeah, anyone over 30, he's not supposed to feel that. But C.J. Stroud joked during his media session today, he feels like this is an off-season storyline because there isn't much to talk about right now. Said he's fine, there's no issue, and was throwing before media got to practice today.
Man, this is what I live for, man.
Horizontal,
yeah, like shaky cell phone footage from the sidelines. I'm watching Andrew Siciliano just tweeted out a clip of, I believe, what number is Shador? Is he 12? Is he 12 right now? Right, I believe. Because I just watched Shador, what I believe to be Shador Sanders, just lace a great 12. Pass over the middle, over the head of a linebacker to a wide receiver. I am just so thrilled. Love minicamp footage. And I love minicamp storylines. So I think that everybody should panic and that the Texans are absolutely cooked because C.J. Stroud cannot throw a football here. No, he's right. Look, this is part of what we're talking, what we're going to discuss. But I don't think my perceived what I perceive to be overvaluing by the market of the Houston Texans is baked into this soreness that C.J. Stroud is dealing with. I just think it's a little bit more of a flawed roster than the market is giving it credit for, specifically on offense. I think this defense is among the best in the NFL. But I still think this looks like a 9-ish win team, as we're talking about, and not one that's going to run away with the division that I think many believe it to be the case. Odds on to make the playoffs, plus 115 favorite to win the AFC South. I don't believe that to be the case. I think it's a little bit more likely that a team like Jacksonville could win this.
Yeah, season. I was going to say, you are a Jags fan. Which
I think it's more anti-Texans than anything, and like the best option is Jacksonville, considering that if the upside hits, especially on offense, like that team's going to be I shouldn't say good, but like in its realm, they're going to be good.
What is your evaluation of Trevor Lawrence? Because I think offensively, it's no secret, that's what it's going to come down to. And he is largely disappointed in his NFL career to this point.
Yeah, I think that is rightfully so. I think that there is a chance that Liam Cohen comes in and brings along an offense that potentially could maximize a lot of what he's going to be able to do at quarterback. So I think he is overpaid. I don't think he's as good as what his salary would say he is. But I still think there's enough upside there that given he is in the right system. And by the way, their skill positions are like sneaky good. At wide receiver, they've got some pretty good pieces that if you're going to put them in the right system, maximize what Lawrence can do here. Like that's an offense that's got really strong upside. So I would say that I think Lawrence has proven himself to be a pretty average quarterback, which is not good given what he is paid to be. But I think that if you put him in, if this system is right, and this team is as forward-thinking as we believe them to be with the front office and the coaching staff that they have put together, I think that there is a strong side. They hit their upside. And then that if that is the case, this is a team that could win a pretty, what would you call it, average, below-average division, right?
I would say average to below-average is a very fair assessment.
Worst division in football?
NFC South still? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but at least with the NFC South, because like what's weighing you down there is obviously like the Saints are awful, but the Bucs are a very good franchise and
Falcons we don't fully know.
Correct. So like if Penix hits, the Bucs are the Bucs, and then we're right. I assume it's we because we're a very pro Carolina
Panthers, sharp teeth and claws.
Right. And if they actually take more steps forward, if Bryce Young is actually taking steps toward being a solid starting quarterback, there's some upside with three of the four teams that you're looking at in that division. In this division, I mean, if Anthony Richardson isn't going to become anything, you already have the Titans. You're like, ugh.
Yeah, so speaking to that, Anthony Richardson dealing with a re-aggravation to an injury that he already had to his shoulder, plus 126 now to be the Colts' week one starter. You got Daniel Jones from a 2-1 dog to now minus 166 favorite in that market. Riley Leonard's still available at 55-1, and I know some people tried throwing that our way the other day. It's not going to be Riley Leonard, okay?
You sure?
I don't think so.
Well, because here's the thing. I mean, if you're – so I'm glad you brought that angle up. So I think that there is a – and is this – let me see. Hold on quickly. This is – oh, so this
let
is
me
FanDuel,
flip that. Anthony Richardson is minus 166.
Right, I was going to say, Daniel our rundown says Daniel Jones minus 166. Graphic says Anthony Richardson. So can we get some accuracy there? Because here's the thing. I don't think
– I am of the belief that Anthony Richardson should still be the favorite, but that Daniel Jones should be the bet.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, actually, my angle here, because I saw Daniel Jones at minus 166 in our rundown here. So Daniel Jones is the odds-on favorite here at minus 166.
Okay. So then you bet Anthony Richardson.
No, I believe that Anthony Richardson is probably not going to start week one.
Yes.
I just you look at the reading of the reports. He is set to rejoin the team sometime in training camp.
Using words like indefinitely.
Yeah, like that doesn't sound, and given his injury history, that just does not sound like good news when it comes to the injury, the fact that it's a reoccurring one, or at least you're bothering an injury that you've already suffered, the fact that you are a team that, or excuse me, I should rephrase it that. The Colts want him, and I've been adamant about this since they signed Daniel Jones. Colts want him to win that job. There's no question. They are desiring that he wins that job. But Stormy, you can only do so much. Mm-hmm. You can only sign Daniel Jones and tell the kid, here you go. Like, come on, go win the job. But at the end of the day, if he's not going to be fully healthy and you're joining the team, I don't know how far into training camp, but let's just say you're already a preseason game in, whatever it is. Daniel Jones has taken a vast majority of those reps. Are you really going to put your team behind the eight ball trying to get him up to speed and running? I think it makes more sense that Jones is going to be the guy. But to the point of Riley Leonard, look, I don't think it's the craziest thing in the world to put something small on Riley Leonard to be the starting quarterback in week one. The bet is literally just, hey, is Daniel Jones going to get injured? Mm-hmm. Because if you're dealing with injuries for both guys, Leonard, I mean, is a diet version of Daniel Jones to an extent. I don't think he's that great of a passer. You can obviously see the similar traits with all three of these guys and what the Colts are going for. Two to three quarterbacks with some athletic upside that can at least throw the ball with some relative reliable nature. But I don't think it's the craziest thing in the world that the things go wrong for Indianapolis in camp in the preseason, and we're looking at Riley Leonard starting week one.
That's a wild statement to me.
I don't think that's going to be good for them.
No,
but I don't think it's the craziest thing in the world that he's taking the first snap for Indianapolis.
That's just a bonkers concept to me, especially based on like what we've seen from Riley Leonard in college to begin with. And I'm not a Daniel Jones fan. I'm actually a well-documented Daniel Jones hater on this network. But he also signed with this team specifically because he figured he would have the opportunity to compete. Mm-hmm. I think it's wild, honestly, that was the way that the Colts were billing it, because that doesn't exactly instill confidence in your young, high draft pick quarterback that you're trying to get the most out of. But I understand the rationale for it. I think it was probably necessary. I just wouldn't have been so vocal about it. But Daniel Jones coming in here, I said weeks ago that I thought Daniel Jones at plus 200, plus 210, whatever the price was, would be a reasonable bet. And now with the injury and not wanting to risk it more with Anthony Richardson, considering it's already a re-aggravation, I agree with you, even at minus 166. If I were putting money in this market, that's where it would be. There are a handful of other props for who will start week one at quarterback with other teams. We mentioned what is going on with the New Orleans Saints right now in the NFC South. Tyler Shuck is a minus 310 favorite there, but I know I've heard a lot of people say Spencer Rattler is thought of very highly still in the organization, plus 210, Jake Haener 40-1. Then with the Cleveland Browns, you mentioned Shador and the highlights that are coming out there, plus 310. This is actually like a pretty condensed market. Everyone is available at plus money in that quarterback room right now. Joe Flacco, your favorite, at plus 116. Kenny Pickett, plus 230. Shador Sanders, plus 310. And then Dylan Gabriel, who we all know was drafted above Shador, over 10-1.
I mean, I don't want to be that guy. I'm a Shador believer. This dates back to pre-draft. I think that he was, I don't know what went behind the fall. I think it's ridiculous he was drafted where he's at. I think he's a better quarterback than Dylan Gabriel. Oh, and a better quarterback prospect than Dylan Gabriel. We'll put it that way. And would it be the craziest thing in the world if he wins the job? I don't think Joe Flacco should be the favorite. That to me is ridiculous. Joe Flacco sucks. We need to stop this. There was this big push last year for everybody who wanted them to start over Anthony Richardson. Y'all got your wish. It went very poorly. I don't understand this love for him being the starting quarterback. Again, this is a market that I think it harkens back to the six games he started for Cleveland at the end of that year, 2 years ago. He's not that guy. Mm-hmm. And so I think Pickett should be the favorite. So in theory, is there value in Kenny Pickett just to be the starter of week one? I believe so. But I think there is a very strong reality in which Shador comes out of this competition, plays well in the preseason, and has a shot at starting week one. But to me, I'd bet Pickett and Sanders. I don't think Joe Flacco is going to start week one.
If Shador was drafted where we all thought Shador would be, where would he be on this odds board?
Right. Well, like, he'd be the favorite.
Yeah, so like that's where I think about this is I don't know what went wrong in the draft process, but based on skill and where he was projected to go, he should have been the favorite in this market. And we've seen what we've seen about Kenny Pickett, and you're right about Joe Flacco 100%. You saw it up close and personal too in Indy. We're going to take a timeout, resetting hour two after this on Money Moves.